Hi, this is Jim, and you are listening to Physics Frontiers. I would just like to let you know that you can find show notes at frontiers.physicsfm.com/32. These show notes include links to the papers that we're going to discuss on tonight's program, and so if you'd like to follow along, you can just go there and download them, and everything will be hunky-dory. Hey, Randy, what's going on?
It's good to hear from you, Jim.
So I was wondering, Randy.
Yeah.
What would you like to talk about today?
Well, this was your idea.
This was my idea?
This was your idea. We're going to do quantum tunneling in the time that it takes for it to happen, which, you know, you pointed out is sort of a vibrant controversy within the field of physics these days and has been for a long time, like 80 years, kind of a long time.
I mean, I had no idea that this was a problem until I was looking at something else, and I just sort of ran into it reading another paper on time and quantum mechanics. And this, I thought, was fundamental, the question about what actually happens in quantum tunneling, how long it takes. And the answers people give are very broad. It can be anything from instantaneous to superluminal to the speed of light or at below the speed of light. They just really don't know.
Yeah, they're really all over the map on that one. It kind of reminds me of, I was on a chat board, a physics chat board, and I was asking how long it takes for electron orbitals to change from one position to the next. And they were telling me that it was considered to be instantaneous. And I was always really dissatisfied with that. Nothing happens in nature faster than the speed of light. Entanglement, maybe, but even that seems suspect. This kind of reminded me of that debate. And I didn't think that we'd have the technology in order to do any measuring in this realm, because tunneling is usually over such small distances, you know?
I think technically your intuition is dead on, that they do think that the transition between orbitals is a quantum tunneling event. Even worse, I was reading in a quantum field theory book, trying to get my head around some of this stuff, that they think that there could be a quantum tunneling event in the universe that will completely destroy the universe. Maybe the universe is in an excited state right now and it'll just collapse into its ground state and then it's all over, and that's going to be a quantum tunneling event.
Yeah, I kind of love that, and it's incredibly menacing. The idea that one little region of space might suddenly drop to a lower energy level and like radiate outward at the speed of light so you'd never see it coming and just obliterate everything in its path. Apparently that's not an inconceivable possibility.
So the tunneling stuff happens all over the place, and people just don't have a really good idea about what's going on with it, even though they have a lot of ideas. And these two papers that we have, what, Tunneling Times, A Critical Review, what would that be, Haag and Stronig? Strony?
I don't know if that's Haag or Haag, but the other name looks maybe Swedish or Scandinavian. Stovning? Oh, I feel terrible butchering somebody's name. Well, that's a 1989 paper.
Yeah, that's an old 1989 paper, but it was one of the two big review papers cited by the second paper, Attosecond Science and the Tunneling Time Problem by Landsman and Keller. It was cited by them as one of the places where you could go to get a good idea about all the different kinds of tunneling times. So even though when you read the Landsman and Keller paper, they have a different take on things, a lot of the times that they're talking about are times in the critical review paper.
I have to confess, though, that it was a little dry.
It's almost as if it was written by physicists. How did you want to proceed here? Did you want to talk a little bit about tunneling first?
Absolutely.
Well, why don't you tell me what you understand about tunneling?
Well, my understanding is that there is some kind of energy barrier, and I guess that can either be some kind of field impediment, or it can be maybe a distance barrier, like you were saying, with quantum orbitals. And the particle basically leaps across that barrier with some probability. And I remember hearing, I think it was Brian Greene on an interview with Art Bell back in the day, saying that there was a non-zero probability that if you were to walk into a wall, that you might go right through it. And I think that he was talking about quantum tunneling in that case.
Yeah, that would be quantum tunneling. That's one of those non-zero probabilities, like there's a non-zero probability that all the air in the room will go to the other side and you'll suffocate to death.
Exactly.
It's one of those fake non-zero probabilities. It's theoretically possible that you can run into the wall and pass through it, but it would probably not be a good idea to test that particular statement.
He even had a number. He even said that if you did it every second for 10,000 billion times the age of the universe, that it might happen.
I'm glad that he actually calculated that.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised. I was like, and how do you even calculate that? Do you have to calculate all the atoms in your body? And I don't know.
Yeah, I think we ought to talk a little bit about that barrier and where it comes from and what it means. if you think about a barrier as a physical sense, if you try to think about a barrier and a ball, what's going to happen with the ball? Let's use a triangular barrier, because they're going to use a triangular barrier later on. Plus, that'll let the ball roll up. So if you roll a ball at a triangular barrier, and you don't have enough energy, if it's not going fast enough, it'll go up and it'll come back down and come back to you. If you roll it fast enough, it will go over, but it's going to be one of those two things. Either you roll it fast enough to go over the barrier, or you roll it too slow and it comes right back, right? So it's either transmitted or reflected, and it's 100% depending on your velocity, depending on the velocity of the particle.
Classically, right.
So that's what would happen with a classical barrier. Now, if you had a wave, what would happen? Let's talk about this in terms of this wave and think about a scattering event at a barrier, at a potential barrier. But let's not have it be a barrier. Let's start off with it being just a high spot in the seafloor. So if you have a wave coming in and it gets to a low spot, gets to a shallow spot, then that wave is going to slow down when it gets there. And some of that wave will actually get pushed backwards, and some of it will slowly go over the thing. And then if it's just a little rectangular barrier, it'll keep on going.
So it'll partially reflect.
At that barrier. It depends on how high that barrier is. There will be spots where you have resonances and stuff like that where it will, you know, completely transmit and stuff like that, but mostly it'll partially reflect and partially transmit. So you'll get some of that wave energy going over the barrier, some of it reflecting back into the same part of the ocean that it was coming from.
But we never see that either with a quantum particle. It either does one or the other.
Well, yeah, we'll get to that in a second. So you could think about quantizing any sort of disturbance. You could still say the same things about little quantized wave disturbances going over or reflecting. So you can still do that with larger macroscopic systems in continuum mechanics. So you don't have to worry too much about that. But we will talk about that in just a moment. Now, if you take that barrier and you make it higher than the ocean or higher than sea level, what's going to happen to that wave when it hits it?
It's always going to reflect, yeah.
You'll never get anything happening on the other side of the barrier if you have this wall coming out of the ocean. That's why people put the seawalls there. So then you have your quantum mechanical particle. Quantum tunneling is just like that seawall. So quantum tunneling is something that happens as you raise a barrier above the point where it has enough energy to go over the barrier. So when you're doing this in your introductory quantum mechanics class, the way they do it is they imagine a continuous wave solution propagating to the right or propagating inwards towards the barrier, and that's your source, that's your incident wave. Then you take that and you solve for that barrier to see how much of it gets transmitted and how much gets reflected. And then you go to the next barrier and do the same thing. So you end up with four solutions, right? You have an incident wave, the initial reflected wave. You have the incident wave, the reflected wave where the incident wave is coming in. Then you have the two propagating solutions on the interior of the barrier, whether that barrier is larger or smaller than the energy of the incoming wave. And then you have the outgoing wave, the total transmitted wave. Then you can proceed in one of two ways. The way that normally somebody would proceed is you set up some boundary conditions based on some continuity of the wave function. So what you're doing is you're taking solutions on each of these regions. So I guess the first thing you do is you look in the small, you look at each of the three regions and you solve Schrodinger's equation and you get generic solutions for each one. Wave propagating to the right, wave coming back to the left, wave coming out for the transmitted, and in the center, you either have for a normal scattering event where the incoming particle has more energy than the barrier. You have a wave on the interior. You have a wave in there. But if the barrier has an energy higher than the energy of the incoming wave, you have two exponentially decreasing solutions, one from the left and one from the right. So I guess one's actually exponentially increasing, but the one that's exponentially increasing is really decreasing from the right instead of increasing from the left. I guess you get your choice on how to think about that.
But doesn't quantum mechanics allow for the wave to cross the barrier if it doesn't have enough energy, but it almost has enough energy because there's some level of noise in the field?
Okay, so what you're thinking about is maybe there's something to do with the uncertainty principle or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
There might be some effect like that, but that is not quantum tunneling. For quantum tunneling, it is literally the decay of the wave function, the exponential decay of the wave function inside of that barrier. So if you just had an infinite, semi-infinite barrier, so it's got a potential going on forever, you just get an exponential decay. And so there'd be a little bit of penetration, but that would all reflect back out. You get 100% reflection, but there would be some sort of penetration into this barrier. Because this barrier is something like an electric field, a magnetic magnetic field or something like that. It's not, you know, just a physical object. Even where it is a physical object. In a magnetic tunnel junction, you have a magnetic lead, a magnetic metal that polarizes the electrons. Then you have a dielectric material in the middle, and that dielectric material is very, very thin on the nanometer scale. And then you have another lead on the other side of another magnetic material. And depending on the relative orientations of those two magnetic materials, you get different tunneling probabilities. But you have this metal insulator metal idea here. So that insulator...
That's your barrier, yeah.
Yeah, the insulator is your barrier. So that's the way that you solve that in your elementary quantum mechanics course. And so what you see is that this quantum mechanical particle, it's not acting like a wave because it can penetrate through a place where it shouldn't penetrate through.
And end up completely on the other side without reflecting at all, right?
And end up transmitted on the other side, or it can come back in the other direction. You know, it's hard to talk about that in terms of the continuous wave solution. However, if you're committed to this continuous wave representing a beam of electrons, for example, which you should be, because that's what a beam of electrons will kind of look like, then you have to say that since the total number of incident electrons has to be equal to the number of reflected electrons plus the number that have been transmitted, because of that, you can make any conclusion that you want to about those particles. Some of them have had to go to the other side, and they're individual particles on that other side. Either they're on one side or they're on the other side. That has to be true. Otherwise, you have some problems in the probability somewhere.
Well, you can't transmit half an electron, right? So,
and in fact, in one of these papers, they make mention of that. The tunneling event is a measurement, a quantum mechanical measurement, period. Which one is it? I think that's the Hagen-Stoney or whatever his name is. Yeah, it is that one on page 928. They're mentioning that for some other reasons. So these two things have to exist. But even better, if you look at the wave function, the total wave function for finding an electron has contributions in all three spots. Okay? So that means that if you look to the left of the barrier, there's a probability you'll find the electron. If you look to the right of the barrier, there's a probability you'll find the electron. If you look in the middle of the barrier, there's a probability that you'll find the electron. It's not teleporting from one side to the other. There's a probability that if you can make a measurement inside the barrier, which you can't do for the tunnel junction, but if this is a completely electrostatic barrier or something like that, then you could do that, right? So this is something that would never, ever, ever happen with a wave. Either the wave is going to go over or it's going to reflect. It's not going to be in the middle of this thing that it can't get over.
I see.
And since it can't go through that middle, it doesn't go to the other side either. It just stays on the left-hand side on its own side.
Something that came up in the second paper, they were talking about electron doing it, going through a tunneling outside of an atom. And they were talking about the electron in, I believe, a helium atom, that when it went through the tunneling process, that it would come out on the other side with zero velocity. What is up with that? Did the electron need to have exactly enough energy to make it through the tunnel?
In that particular case, they have an atom inside of a very strong electric field. Basically, it's a laser, and they have two ways of getting out of that. One of those is looking at the oscillatory solutions, which are basically photons. So the photons keep hitting the atom until one of the electrons jumps out. And they call that the multi-photon escape route. And the other one is when one of these valence atoms just sort of decides to go to the other side of the barrier.
The valence electrons jumps to the other side of the barrier, and it's a non-adiabatic process, right? So it doesn't actually absorb any photons when it does this.
It's non-adiabatic. Adiabatic means it does no work. So you're saying that the non-adiabatic doesn't absorb. I would have thought it was the other way around.
Oh, no, yeah, I got it backwards. I meant that the process of tunneling, they were saying, was an adiabatic process. So it doesn't absorb the photon when it tunnels, is that right? But it gets somehow pushed by the electric field of the laser.
What's going to happen is that there's going to be a probability. So this thing already has an energy because it's in a valence state.
Okay, so they're not talking about a ground state. They're talking about an excited state already.
It can still be in a ground state. But, you know, they're ionizing, so the most likely electron to ionize is going to be which one? The one with the most energy. That's going to be doubly true for this particular case because the probability has increased both because the potential is higher, so there's less of a potential jump that it has to go over. And on top of that, there's a shorter distance that it has to tunnel through. And the probability decreases exponentially with that distance. So it's most likely going to be that one. Basically, as far as the exterior speed is concerned, it's probably not moving very fast to begin with.
But does the tunneling electron take any energy from the photons of the laser beam?
If it's tunneling, then the photons of the laser beam aren't hitting it. That's a multi-photon process. Mm-hmm. So there are two things going on with that laser beam. One is that it's got all these photons that are plinking the atom. And the other is that it has this gigantic electric field, this giant change in the potential, which is sharp enough that there's a narrow enough barrier for electrons to tunnel through. Now, as I understood it, at least in some of those tunneling processes, maybe not in the helium, but in some of these processes, the electron that tunnels is going to be directed in the direction of the electric field of the laser.
Which I think is it perpendicular to the laser, that direction?
I don't know.
Okay, because I'm looking at the first diagram, and it has an energy in the vertical scale. That's the multi-photon direction. And I assume that was the direction of the laser beam, because it would be absorbing momentum in that direction.
This is what happens when you put too much work into the graphs.
Hmm.
I mean, it says something about it being perpendicular in the up direction in the text. But that scale is an energy scale, so you can't think about that as being perpendicular to the direction of tunneling.
Oh, I see. That's not the propagation of energy. That's the energy scale along that axis.
And they were saying somewhere in the text that if it's a multi-photon process, then they think, they didn't give any evidence for this, but they think that that electron can be going in any direction.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense. What they're showing here is that the tunneling process doesn't expend or absorb energy. That's a lateral move. Now, can we think that the electric field generated by the photon beam is creating like a zero resistance path for the electrons to travel? Is that potential creating the conditions for an electron to flow and get outside of the Coulomb attraction?
Yes, and that's how they detect it.
Okay.
When the electrons get out of the potential well that is the atom, that electric field shunts them towards the detector. You know, it's not perfectly efficient. If another atom is ionized and this electron happens to get close enough to that ion...
Yeah, it'll get absorbed.
And there was something else called a higher harmonic generation, which I wasn't really sure exactly what it was, but that's going to change the energy of the electron, and that comes out as a higher harmonic of, right, the laser frequency. I'm guessing based on the name, I'm assuming it does the same sort of thing as second harmonic generation.
Now, when it tunnels to the other side, I'm gathering from this diagram that it ends up with the same energy that it started with.
It ends up with the same energy that it started with, but that potential energy has a slope. It's a really big slope, and so that electron's going to accelerate in the direction of the electric field.
It's going to want to go down that slope, right? All right, so let's get down to the nitty-gritty. There was the controversy about how long it takes this to...
That wasn't the nitty-gritty. We've been doing this for 30 minutes.
That was just the setup. Okay, so the real question that's been burning in the minds of physicists for 80 years is how long does it take for that particle to make it through the tunnel?
And they've got plenty of answers.
They do. And most of them are wrong, apparently.
These guys didn't really like very many of them. And then when they've checked it with experiments, they still didn't like them.
But yeah, they did end up with one that seemed to fit reasonably well, as I recall.
I don't really want to spoil the paper for anyone, but with...
No spoilers, Jim.
But the error bars that they have are all large enough that zero is included. Some of these guesses for what the time could be are too large to be included to pass the experimental test. But, you know, if you've got error bars with zero in it and you have a non-zero theory, it's nice that you're still included, but it doesn't really say too much about whether or not you're right or not. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Well, I guess you're kind of a runner-up, but if you're not right in the middle, well, that's where the popular solution is.
What you'd prefer is to have a lower bound and an upper bound. And then if you have a lower bound and an upper bound, if your lower bound is the lowest possible thing ever, it's not really that great. I mean, it's possible that it's instantaneous, right?
Yeah, but they ruled that out, didn't they?
How did they rule that out?
I thought that in this experiment, they know that it's not an instantaneous jump through the tunnel, and they know that it's not a superluminal jump. Isn't that right?
There were... two different experiments, and they contradicted each other.
Oh, rats, I must have missed that part.
So I think the experiment that you were talking about is the one where they have the limits that include zero.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have any lower limit beyond its instantaneous. The other one was a Josephson junction, so it was some superconductive tunneling. And that one seemed to work with one of the theories, I think the Boudicca-Landauer theory. That was not one of the theories that passed that other test. So there may be an issue here just based on that. They said in there that maybe with this 40 attosecond limit that a lot of people think that you should be looking at different kinds of particles because that had something to do with photons, and they'd really like to have something like an electron that you know is going to work with the Schrodinger equation. 40 attosecond one had something going on where people didn't think it satisfied the Schrodinger equation. However, for optimal comparison with theories presented in Section 3, the tunneling time of a non-relativistic electron, as opposed to a photon, in other words, a particle that obeys the Schrodinger equation, is desirable. And obviously, there's no such thing as a non-relativistic photon.
But isn't that what they were doing with this VMIS experiment? Weren't they exciting electrons from helium and therefore testing the models properly?
I'm not completely sure. When I went over this again today, I still wasn't completely sure about what was going on with the experiment because, you know, you have this 24-page paper and you have half a page on what this experiment is that they're talking about, and it really wasn't enough. I should have downloaded the experiments that they were talking about.
You know what it might be? Maybe they're talking about the interaction, and maybe they're saying that it would be better to have like an electron beam exciting the helium atoms to make them emit an electron so that everything would speak the same language, so to speak.
Possibly, because they are still looking at electrons, but I'm not completely sure what they mean, because, again, that was one sentence. It's hard for me to figure that out without going through and reading the previous papers.
It is some complicated stuff, but whenever you get into these kind of experiments, you know, especially these optical-oriented kind of experiments, they get extremely technical.
Well, I mean, the experimental papers are going to be very technical, but that can be an issue. If you don't know what the equipment does, then all the description in the world can't help you.
But they did sum up some of their conclusions to help us get to the meat of the results that they had. I wrote down a note. They said the Boedeker-Landauer and the Eisenbud-Wegener and the Pollack-Miller models all predicted a travel time of tunneling that were at least twice as large as what they detected.
At least 200 attoseconds.
That's right. And what they detected was less than 100 attoseconds. So that does kind of rule them out. And they ended up with two models that did show reasonable agreement with their measurements. The Larmor time and the probability distribution of tunneling times using that Feynman path integral formulation.
Yeah, so they had the path integral and the Larmor thing. Though, you know, they went through and did something that was supposed to show that those two were formally identical.
And, oh, I guess it doesn't matter since they're both identical, but this is how they ended up with this conclusion that it may not be a deterministic scenario at all, that there could be a probability distribution of travel times through the tunnel.
Well, there should be. I gave you just a second ago, maybe about 30 minutes ago, the description of how you solve one of these things in your elementary quantum mechanics class. But if you start thinking about this as a wave packet, you don't have that same continuous wave solution, sort of steady state, where you can assume that everything has the same probability all the time. So instead, you have one of these minimal uncertainty wave packets, a Gaussian wave packet, which Aharonov told us isn't any good. We have to use that test function one, which is more complicated to use. But you use this Gaussian wave packet, and this is the way Bohm does it in his book. You use that guy, and then you just let it propagate and see what happens. So let's imagine a scattering event before we talk about the tunneling event. In that case, you know, your wave packet is traveling along and it hits this region where it has to slow down. And when it hits that, some of it goes through that slower region slower and some of it gets pushed back the other direction. And so your wave packet splits basically into two, one that keeps traveling forward at a slower speed and would therefore have a narrower size, and one is going backwards with the same size and the same speed. Then that one that's going forward hits another barrier, right, which is the drop. And if you do the mathematics, and this is one of the things that I spent way too much time playing around with this week reading these papers, is actually doing the mathematics, you get exactly the same reflection and transmission coefficients for that barrier, going from high to low and going from low to high. So you get a reflected wave and a transmitted wave. Some of this particle transmits, some of it goes back, and then it hits the first barrier again. And some of that transmits, and now is part of the reflected amount, and some of it goes forward, and it keeps on doing that until technically forever, but, you know, basically until you're out of probability. So if you look at that probabilistically, each one of those things where I say there's a transmitted wave going back and going forward, we just say there's a probability of going forward and going backwards. So you stop looking at them as individual waves. You can think about that. If one electron has to follow one path, then what it's going to do is it's going to go in, bounce around a couple of times, and come out. Or it can just reflect, or it can just transmit, or whatever. but it's going to do one of many, many, many things. So sometimes it'll have sort of the minimum transit time, and sometimes it'll have some multiple of whatever that transit time is. And I think that's pretty similar to what you see in the probability distribution thing that they give you with all the little spikes at the end. I'm not sure because I don't know exactly how they made it, but you know, I was thinking about that when I was doing it. You know, the idea about what I'm seeing qualitatively in the mathematics looks a lot like their plot. So I was talking a little bit about all those different reflections inside of the scattering event. Well, if you look at tunneling, you no longer have the scattering event. But if you just look at the way things happen, you have an incident wave. Some of it reflects. And then the amplitude of the wave decreases exponentially till it gets to the next barrier. Then some of it will reflect and some of it will transmit. Well, if you have this stuff coming in and then you have some stuff coming out, and the stuff coming out is less than the stuff coming in, what does that mean about the rest of that stuff? Well, that stuff's all reflected, which means that one way you can think about this tunneling barrier, what's going on in there, is that all of these things that are exponentially decaying are actually reflecting back toward the original spot. So anything that doesn't actually get transmitted has to be reflected. So that includes the initial reflection plus some infinitesimal reflections every infinitesimal step along the way that the wave function is decaying.
No, so they can get to any depth within the barrier and still find their way back out the other direction.
Well, that has to happen because you still have to have the same number of electrons coming out.
Overall, right.
Being either reflected or transmitted as you had coming in. So if it doesn't get transmitted, it has to be reflected.
Yeah, I was just confused about how deep they can go into the barrier. They can go almost to the complete end, huh?
Well, if you're getting tunneling, then...
That goes all the way out, yeah.
Yeah, they have to get to the end. But it's an exponential decrease. So technically, if you have a step, if you have a semi-infinite barrier, where you have a barrier that goes on to infinity, technically, no matter how far out you get, you have a probability of finding the electron being there. It's just it gets to that running into the wall problem again.
It seems kind of odd that they can't get into the barrier and just stop.
I mean, it depends on the barrier.
Okay, right,
If it's an electrostatic barrier, then that's true. And in both of these cases, they're specifically ignoring situations where the electron could get stuck. You can imagine that in that magnetic tunnel junction, it is possible for that electron to get stuck somewhere in that dielectric and just start charging up the dielectric. So that would be a possibility. I don't know how much it happens. You can have actual losses in a real system like that. If you're talking about ionizing an electron, right? You know, in a material, you'll generally think that there's going to be some loss somewhere because there always is. It's a big, complicated, messy system. Something's going to happen. You will have some loss of electrons at some spot that has nothing to do with your simple quantum description. But for transitions between energy levels and stuff like that, you shouldn't get stuck somewhere in between there because it just isn't a place where you can actually exist.
Yeah, there's no valley.
Yeah, you can look at this as a continuous reflection, but you also then have to do a continuous reflection as it tries to make its way back, and then continuous reflection again in either direction, and so forth and so on. So I would not try to think about it that way if you're trying to solve a problem. And so that's one way you get some sort of time. The other is through that path integral.
Right, because it can go on all kinds of weird paths through the barrier, huh? And it can interfere with itself, right?
And that's going to be a problem for calculating a tunneling time, is that those self-interference terms sometimes do funny things, and it's hard to figure out exactly what the dwell time is. But yeah, they can interfere with itself. This is sort of what always happens with a path integral, is that there's a formal process of looking at all these different paths, assigning them probabilities, and seeing basically what the average path is, and you're saying that's the most likely path, and that's probably what it really, really is, because, you know, it's a very, very sharp Gaussian around that path. But if you look at the picture that they gave with that barrier, they've got these electrons going backwards in time, they've got them going instantaneously in some direction, a lot of them are going instantaneously in some direction, got them stopping and then going again. I mean, they've got all sorts of things going on, overshooting where they're supposed to be and then coming back. They've got all those things going on. In fact, they overshoot where it's supposed to be in time and then comes back in one of them. I was supposed to be there an hour ago.
It's like, I gotta go back in time for a second.
So that's another way you could get a distribution in those times, is that there's a probability that any of those paths could occur, but usually the phases in most of those things are going to cancel out, and you only get the most probable path. But the smaller the region, the more likely you are to get those funny things.
Interesting. I didn't realize there was a probability that a particle could go backwards in time.
Well, I think that's one of the things that I cut out of this time travel one. In the Compton effect, when you describe that with quantum electrodynamics, you actually do have to include probabilities. Well, you can interpret it in one of two ways, of the electron going up, going backwards in time, and then going back up. So it's traveling along, going backwards in time, and then traveling up again. Or the other way to think about this is you've got an electron traveling around in the photon, and then the photon decides it wants to be an electron and a positron. Then the new electron goes off and does its own thing, and the old electron just happens to hit the positron, and you have that same frequency radiation coming out. So that's actually a part of the quantum electrodynamical description of some elementary experiments.
All right. And that was the physics of time travel episode. That was a fun one.
That was a fun one. We very much enjoyed it, and so did all of you, we noticed in the comments.
Yeah. So let's see here. Where does that leave us?
I'm not sure. The only thing we haven't talked about is what all those different theories of the times are. So, I mean, we've talked about all the experiments, and we talked about tunneling, and we've talked about tunneling in more detail than anybody really wants to hear. But we haven't really talked about that time. I think we got sidetracked on the experiments a little before we were ready for them. That's okay. So now we know what the experiments say. So let's go back in time to 1989 and talk about what the ideas about what could be going on were at that time. So in that Hagen Stoneny. In that particular case, what they're doing is they're looking at a bunch of different ways people were proposing to measure that tunneling time. And they have two types of ideas that aren't completely satisfactory that they say are good. And there are a whole bunch that they're a little concerned with. And one they say is just no good. Do you want to tell us about the two that were good? Do you remember the dwell time?
I do remember the dwell time.
And the asymptotic phase time?
You know, maybe you should get into that, because the asymptotic phase time, I don't remember that one too clearly.
Well, I mean, the dwell time is pretty much what you'd expect it to be. It's the time in a region of space where the electron is going to be.
And it's an average sum, right?
Well, yeah. What happens is that you have to include all the contributions from both the transmitted and the reflected wave. When they're talking about the different channels, they're including both of those. Now, for the reflective wave, there is some interpenetration of the reflected wave into the barrier. So if you're looking at the dwell time in the barrier, because the dwell time can be defined outside of the barrier too, but what do you care? Then some of the time that there's going to be an electron in the barrier is going to be electrons that are not going to make it through the barrier and are going to reflect. So you actually get an average dwell time in proportion to the number of reflected electrons and their time inside of that region, their time inside of that barrier, summed with the proportion of transmitted electrons and their time inside of the barrier. That's what they mean by the channels. One is the reflected and one is the transmitted. One takes more time than the other one on average, but there's nothing you can do about that.
Can't you fire them through one at a time to see so that you just measure the dwell time of the transmitted ones?
The only thing you could measure would be those asymptotic phase times.
Okay.
If you actually look at a particular particle, a particular experiment, what you're doing is you're somewhere out in the middle of nowhere and you pulse your laser or you toss a single electron at your barrier or something. It travels there. It starts to interfere and bunch up when it hits the barrier. Some of it penetrates through the barrier and then you measure that at the far end. And that would be your transmitted phase time. And some of it will reflect back and that will be your reflected phase time. So basically there's going to be at least four contributions to each of those measurements. One will be the approach to the barrier. One will be the interference at the barrier, because at the barrier, the wave slows down.
It slows down because part of it gets reflected on itself.
Okay, well, actually, I shouldn't say that, because that's actually a thing of contention. That's true of the scattering. That's not true of the tunneling. Part of it will be the incident wave. Part of it will be the self-interference as the wave bunches up as it gets close to the barrier. Some of it will be going backwards, and some of it will be getting transmitted through and stuff like that. Some of that will be the time in the barrier, and some of that will be the time coming back to the detector. So you've got all four of those things. That's what you actually measure, is that asymptotic time. Now you can get a pretty good idea about what those times are, or what that intermediate time is, because you know where the detector is, you know where the barrier is, you know where the source is. If you know the source and you know how much energy you're giving each one of these electrons, then you can just subtract the time from the source to the barrier and subtract the time from the barrier to the detector, and then you get a number. That number is the extrapolated phase time, which includes that transmitted dwell time plus the slowdown because of the interference effects.
Right, and you can't separate those two, so you can't get a precise measurement on the time in the barrier, right?
There was one other thing that they were talking about, which is even less fun.
Uh-oh, what's that?
They were saying that there's a pre-selection. There's a selection of tunneled electrons so that the amount of tunneling varies depending on the momentum of the electron. And because this is quantum mechanics, you can localize to some extent your wave packet, so you get that Gaussian wave packet, but then you also get a Gaussian momentum distribution with your Gaussian position distribution, which means that one, these wave packets are always broadening, and two, they have a distribution of momenta. Those distribution of momenta give you different speeds inside of the barrier, and they give you different reflection coefficients at the barrier, so that the transmitted electrons are slightly faster, I believe, than the incident electrons, and the reflected electrons are slightly slower than the incident electrons.
Well, that makes sense.
They were saying that there's a filtering process there because this is where they were talking about the barrier actually being a measurement. There's a filtering process because the barrier is a measurement, so you have a little more uncertainty than you wanted because you don't really know what the energy of these electrons coming out are. So that makes things even worse.
Yeah, how do you even factor that?
But that's just a technical problem. That's not a theoretical problem. Trying to separate the dwell time and the interference time is more difficult. The interference delay, I guess.
Yeah, they didn't know how to do that, did they?
Nobody said anything about figuring out how to do that. So you end up with these issues. You can figure out what this asymptotic transmission time is, and you can figure out the asymptotic reflection time, but you can't extrapolate those down to something useful, add them together, and get that total dwell time. Things don't work out quite as nicely as you'd like.
Which is how this has remained a perplexing puzzle for the last several decades, I guess.
Yeah, no matter what you decide is the way to do it, somebody has a good reason why it doesn't work.
Well, that was before they did these experiments. They were able to get a ballpark result, right?
I don't know, because I don't remember these attosecond experiments talking about either of those times. I think they're trying to figure out the extrapolated transmission time.
It was the extrapolated phase times they were looking at in the first paper, huh?
Yeah, I think when you're doing the measurement, you're really looking at extrapolated time, and I think they're looking at extrapolated phase times. Each one of these is a different version of that.
When they say phase times, they're referring to measuring the peak of the energy wave of the packet?
Yeah, they're doing exactly the same thing that Bohm does in his quantum mechanics book, which is look at the peak of the wave packet and just keep track of where it's supposed to be at any particular time.
But then there was an issue that came up where they're talking about how there's a reshaping of the energy because of that momentum distribution that you were talking about earlier that can make it look like the peak is traveling faster than the speed of light through the barrier.
That again happens because of the differences in the transmission times. So it looks like the transmitted particle has a narrower distribution of positions than you'd expect from just, you know, having that particle go all the way through without going through the barrier. And since it's cutting out the low frequency stuff, it looks like it sort of looks a little bit farther ahead than it would have been, assuming that, you know, the positions and the momenta were completely independent.
That reminds me of an experiment where they were ostensibly sending a signal through like some kind of Bose-Einstein condensate or something at what looked like the wave exited the apparatus before it entered. And I think it has something to do with the phase shape of the particles because they were in a certain state. So they were like responded to just the very front of the incident wave, and that caused an energy to exit on the other side very quickly before the peak arrived at the apparatus. That was kind of fascinating, but it's an illusion.
You've already got this wave broadening. You've already got things with different speeds coming in. You just sort of do something to exacerbate that difference, and then you get something that looks like it's superluminal.
Well, it's kind of sad that they ruled that out as an option for the... I think they ruled that out as an option for the tunneling, right?
I don't remember which one it was when they were talking about that. Do you remember which...
Well, I guess, I mean, in the end, they came up with the Feynman path integral solution, which was a probability distribution on the times. So I guess some of them, it wouldn't be the center of the probability of the measurements that would be superluminal, but I guess some small part of it might be in that bell-shaped probability distribution, right, for times?
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking at this, then there should be something going on that is going to have a different value for the speed.
I wish they would have given specific numbers on the speeds. Right? It would have been neat to see what the speed distribution they calculated was. Like, we know that the average time was 100 attoseconds for that VMIS experiment. Maybe I'm just too lazy. I didn't calculate what the distances were and what the time was. But it would be interesting to know how fast an electron tunnels on average, and then to see what the distribution was like, to see what the range of velocities was, you know?
If they can do that. The nice thing about those phase times is that they're defined for individual particles, whereas the dwell time is not. But actually getting numbers out of them is sort of the next step of the story, and it might not be that simple.
However, since the tunneling time measured by the atto clock was actually less than 100 atto seconds, it could be assumed that the electric field stayed relatively constant during the tunneling process. Oh yeah, they were talking about how the frequency of the photons was so much larger than the transit time that it would take to get through the tunnel. So it was essentially, for that all intents and purposes, basically constant, but not entirely. They're saying this is that in order to factor that in to get more precise measurements, it's going to be a highly non-trivial task.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what you say when you're looking for funding.
Yeah, we need equipment, we need people, we need time. Let's do it.
Is there something else you'd like to talk about? Do you want to really talk about these different things, the complex time and stuff like that?
You know, that's an interesting theoretical tool, but like both of these papers seem to focus on is like we're interested in the real time. The imaginary time doesn't really help us measure the dwell time or, you know, the velocity through the tunnel. So
yeah, and what it actually is difficult to get your hand around. It has something to do with decay, but what exactly it has to do with decay, you know, you're not really sure about.
So was there anything else in here that interested you that would you like to go over?
Yeah, nothing that's that interesting. There are two clocks in here. There's the Lemoore clock, which is something they're using to keep track of how long the particles in the barrier. What you're going to do is you're going to induce some precession in the spin. So if there'll be some precession in the spin. So you can look at how much the spin is precessed, figure out how long it was actually in the barrier, or at least that's what they hope.
That was a clever idea. You know exactly the rate of precession, so you can use that to measure how it changed by the time it gets out of the tunnel.
Yes, and that gets connected to the dwell time and all that other fun stuff. And it's also the one that is not knocked out by the experiments, or at least interpretation of the experiments from Landsman and Keller. So that seems to be the most important one of those to look at. You know, the one with the oscillating barrier, maybe that's interesting, maybe that's not. We already talked about the extrapolated times and stuff like that. So I think we've got most of the interesting stuff here. I don't think we need to hit too many other things. It would be nice to understand better what the Lemoore clock was and what the atto second clock actually was, but I don't, and I don't think we're going to get too much better with that just by talking about it tonight.
Yeah, one of the clever things that they did in this experiment was how they rotated the phase of their laser light to use that as a clock.
Okay, so that's what the atto clock is. That gave it some sort of momentum in the x direction that they were able to measure, which basically resulted in a tilting of the data in the xy plane. That's a clever way to do it, and it looks like they're pretty good at that.
It's amazing they could do it that fast that they could get like a high precision measurement of the times.
Yeah, I mean, this high speed measurement stuff has been increasing very, very rapidly. It was still femtosecond stuff when I was in graduate school.
I remember those articles, all the miraculous stuff they were able to photograph, like molecules merging and so forth. Yeah, now they're taking movies of electrons changing orbitals and so forth.
Oh, is that what they have in here? I didn't see those movies.
Well, no, it wasn't in the papers or anything, but I've seen stuff like that on physorgs.com.
Physorgs?
Physorg.
All right. I mean, that seems like about enough of this for me. I'm not sure about you.
This was a difficult subject. They're very technical papers. It's neat to see them working on this and actually getting some real answers, rather than, you know, like they pointed out in the beginning of this attosecond science paper, that the people in one branch of research were basically just assuming that it was an instantaneous jump. And people with, you know, in condensed matter physics were, you know, looking at it a little more prosaically.
Yeah, the attosecond people were just assuming it was instantaneous, and the condensed matter people were saying that it had to take some time. Now, on top of that, if you remember, there was one experiment that said it took some time and one experiment that said it was instantaneous, 40 attoseconds or less, and the one with the Josephson junctions that took some amount of time, that one was condensed matter, and the other one was this attosecond one.
So you really do find what you're looking for?
Possibly. And possibly in the different regimes, different things are actually happening. Remember, again, in that barrier in condensed matter, more things can happen. So because of that, it's possible that different things are happening.
Well, I thought that the other team had measured what looked like an instantaneous leap through the barrier because the model they were using was flawed.
That can happen too. But I don't think that's what they said about the Josephson thing.
No, I don't think it was that one. It was another experiment.
There was definitely one where they thought it was superluminal that probably wasn't. And I think that was where they were talking about the pulse reshaping.
Yeah, that's right.
How many times in the past 5 years has somebody seen something going faster than the speed of light? And then they say, oh, wait, no, we forgot there was a repeater there, or there was a little bit of stress in one of the wires and just sort of looked that way. That's just going to happen. There's going to be places where you can't figure out what the error was until a week after something actually gets published.
Yeah, that's what happened with the European fiber optic experiment. Everybody was talking about, oh, they've detected a superluminal signal that's like 0.01% faster than the speed of light. And you're like, no, no, that's an experimental error.
You almost had it.
Or thought you had it, which is worse.
I mean, you got to know that these guys were sitting around for a year, you know, trying to figure out what the problem was. Redoing calculations, testing different components, stuff like that, as best they could.
Oh, and they missed it. And then they published, and then they found it.
That's how it always works, right? Sit around in private trying to make sure that nothing's wrong with what you're doing. Then you decide, okay, I'll go public with this. And then, you know, within a week, you find all these problems and everybody can see them. I mean, if you're bashful about being wrong, then you may as well not even try.
Oh, I don't know. I wouldn't want to go up against Einstein with any paper unless I had checked every nut and bolt, you know?
I've read people's accounts of that. It doesn't matter if you check every nut and bolt. He still found something. It's like we were talking about earlier with the papers. If you're sending a paper into review, make sure there are some glaring problems with your English so that the reviewer can focus on that. Instead of on the really important flaw that he's going to find, right? No matter how careful you are, things you can't find are things you can't find, usually until after you've stopped looking at them for a while. Does you no good to try to find the flaws right away. You have to let it go for a week, come back to it, and then all of a sudden all the problems are glaring. I don't know if that happens with you.
Oh my God, all the time.
Oh, that's why you were inhaling that way.
Yeah, because sculpture is absolutely like that. You know, you think it looks great under whatever lighting conditions or fatigue or whatever that you've been subjected to, and then you get pulled away for a couple of days and you go back and look at it and you're just like, oh my God, I've missed so much.
If you're creating something, you got to get away from it for a second every once in a while.
Rodin would hold on to pieces for years because he knew that every time he looked at it, after he had looked away and forgotten about it for a while, when he went back to it, he'd find more stuff to make better.
Oh, that's good. I mean, as long as you don't have to eat.
Yeah, I guess when you're Rodin, you can afford to do that.
Could he? I don't know enough about Rodin. Was he just rich?
He got very successful pretty quickly. So he could afford to take a few years and make the Musée de Beaux-Arts wait, you know, 30 years for the gates of hell.
You've got that luxury. Then you've got that luxury.
Yeah, I'm working for that luxury. I'm trying to get that luxury myself so I can do a bunch of perfect work.
All right, Randy. I think that's about it for this.
Sounds good. Thanks for your time, Jim.
Thanks for talking to you. Bye now.
All right. Good night.
You have just listened to Physics Frontiers number 32, Tunneling Time. Show notes can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/32. The notes include links to the papers we discussed on the program tonight. Tunneling Times, a Critical Review by E.H. Haig and J.A. Strowning, or Strovning, depending on how literal I want to take that, of The Ohio State University. The second paper was Attosecond Science and the Tunneling Time Problem by Alexandra S. Landsman-Heller of ETH Zurich. I have their webpage open right now. Nobody wants me to try to pronounce the name of that institution. Other links will be included at any time based on whatever I find pertinent from my reading or from browsing the web or whatever. Also, we'd like to ask you for your support on Patreon at www.patreon.com/physicsfrontiers. Anything you can give will be a great help, and we'd very much appreciate it. Good night.